Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Clay Masters, in for Ben Kiefer, live in the Law Library of the Iowa State Capitol. IPR State House correspondent Joyce Russell is also here. We're talking about Medicaid on the show today. That's the joint state-federal health care program for low-income and disabled Iowans. And in 2016, former Governor Terry Branstad turned the management of Medicaid over to three for-profit companies. We're talking about more than 600,000 Iowans on Medicaid affected by this change. It was seen as a way to save costs. Other states have done similar things. But there have been problems. Complaints about Medicaid from hospitals, doctors, and patients spiked. Governor Kim Reynolds, who was lieutenant governor when privatization of Medicaid was implemented, made clear in her condition of the state address at the outset of the legislative session that solving Iowa's Medicaid issues is a priority of her office. Here's what she said back in January.
Well, after being sworn in as governor, I took deliberate action to make a change. I hired a new director for the Department of Human Services who has the passion and, most importantly, the compassion to make this work. And he has hired a new Medicaid director with the experience to get things turned around. With this new team in place, we are working with our caregivers to resolve issues in a timely manner and ensure on-time payments. We're continuing to work with our managed care organizations to ensure Iowans are getting the best possible outcomes. And we're reaching patients in new and innovative ways to individualize their care. This is something that I think about and work on every day, because it is so important to so many Iowans. And my promise to you is we will make this right.
That's Governor Kim Reynolds back in January during her condition of the state address. Now here we are in April, and last week the state's ombudsman issued a report that says disabled Iowans are being denied medical services or having them reduced in a, quote, stubborn and absurd way that makes a mockery out of the state's appeal process. With me for the first part of the show is Iowa's ombudsman, Christy Hirschman, here to tell us about her report from last week. Christy, hello.
Thank you for having me.
So first of all, I think let's just set a definition of what your role is, what your job is as an ombudsman.
Well, we are an independent, nonpartisan agency. We're housed within the legislative branch, and our job is to review complaints about state and local government. We don't have jurisdiction over the governor, the legislature, or the judicial branch. And if we accept a complaint and investigate it and confirm that it's a valid complaint, then we try and persuade the agency to fix the problem. We don't have any enforcement authority.
So tell me about this report. I mean, these are some pretty harsh words.
Well, Iowa Code Chapter 2C requires me to file an annual report by April 1st every year with the legislature and the governor, and that is what this report is. And it outlines our statistics and provides case summaries of the work that we've done this year. And because managed Medicaid complaints were up 157%, we felt appropriate to share some of the most egregious examples of problems that that we've come across.
And how long have you been monitoring this?
Well, we've been receiving complaints ever since managed Medicaid was implemented.
And can you give us some examples or some of the bullet points or the highlights of the concerns that were in this ombudsman report?
Well, some of the case summaries include problems with reduction in services, lack of notices for appeal, a revolving appeal cycle for the same issue, a 71% reduction in services for a quadriplegic, and we also worked 18 months to resolve a six-figure payment problem for one provider.
So these personal stories that you're hearing, I mean, is there kind of a main theme that you derive from this report?
I would say that there needs to be additional oversight by the Department of Human Services to resolve some of these ongoing persistent problems that we're seeing.
And what are some of the recommendations? Can you make recommendations in your role as a nonpartisan organization?
We can make recommendations to the agency on how to resolve systemic issues and individual problems with individual cases.
And systemic issues, what are they? Like, let's lay them out.
Well, again, we've seen lack of notice, so a reduction in services. Without a notice, it's difficult/impossible for people to appeal the reduction in services.
So a lack of a notice, so somebody's just getting, they're not understanding why something has happened, they don't know about it ahead of time. Let's personalize some of these. Let's talk about how people are not getting these notices. Give us some examples.
Well, as an example, I believe, one of the stories, case summaries that we had, and I guess in this particular case, he did receive notice, but a reduction in 71% of the services that he had previously been receiving. And that's a significant problem when there's not been a change in somebody's condition.
And is there, how much are you speaking, do you speak individually with the different people who have filed these complaints, or are these complaints that you're reading, how much interviewing do you do with the people that have filed these complaints?
Oh, that's how all the complaints come to us, is via email or letter or phone, and that's how we address the complaints with the agency.
And are there highlights of concerns that you hear from these personal stories? I mean, is there something that just sticks out time and time again?
Their frustration with the fact their services have been cut and they don't believe their condition has changed. Their frustration, especially from providers, for not getting paid in a timely manner and having to rebill and rebill and rebill for their services. There's frustration that they've attempted in numerous ways to resolve the complaint before getting to us, and that it's taking so long for them to get these issues addressed.
And I've talked with people who are on Medicaid, especially early on, just it all seems to start with just confusion. I mean, confusion in the system, confusion as to why denial is happening, confusion that then leads to frustration. What kind of an outlet do these concerned Iowans have aside from your office to voice these concerns?
Well, there's the Managed Care Ombudsman who handles member complaints from long-term support services. Those members receiving long-term support services, they exist to advocate on behalf of those members. And I know for a fact that individuals are complaining to legislators about the issues that they've run into also.
And what kind of feedback do you get from the governor's office or from the legislative branch? Are you receiving feedback, or is this information that you give to the state government?
We don't get feedback from the governor's office we've had some legislators contact us regarding concerns that they have. But again, my job is to make Department of Human Services and the legislature aware of the problems that we're seeing.
What is the most important takeaway from the report that came out last week?
I think the important takeaway is that there's still problems with the system. I'm sure, without a doubt, that there are success stories with Managed Medicaid. My job is not to say whether Managed Medicaid is good or bad. My job is to identify valid problems and make people aware of those, people that can resolve those problems.
Are you affected by these changes by Medicaid? What's been your experience working within the system? We want to hear from you. Our phone number is 866-780-9100. You can email us at rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. You can also talk to us on social media on Facebook, or you can also tweet us at IPR Talk. We have some lawmakers in the room. We'll get to them here in a moment. But first, I want to turn to our IPR State House correspondent, Joyce Russell, co-hosting the show with me today. There has been some legislation introduced. This is something that is being talked about at the legislative level. Kind of bring us up to speed here, Joyce.
Well, this started, there was a more sort of broad Department of Human Services bill initially in the session. And then these changes to provide more oversight to Medicaid were amended to that bill. There's broad support, bipartisan support. This passed unanimously in the Iowa House. It went to the Senate, and there were concerns there, particularly about the cost of it. There are some things in there that the overall cost was going to approach $5 million. They balked at that. The House has scaled the bill back so that it's less expensive. It has passed the, it sort of got a second life in the Appropriations Committee, which is you know, not subject to deadlines. Mm-hmm. So it has passed the Appropriations Committee. It's unanimously, and it's now available in the for debate in the full House. And the senators who initially resisted the original bill because of the cost, they appear more interested in this, and it looks likely that there will be some agreement in the Senate this time.
And, I mean, we're coming up against deadlines here that the legislature should adjourn at some point, and this is something that was a priority from the outset. And it seems there are multiple people at the table, both sides of the aisle, that want to see something happen.
Yes, I think it's safe to say that this began as a Republican initiative from Governor Branstad, but there's, Republicans and Democrats alike have fielded these complaints. And so, as I said, this is now a bipartisan effort.
Speaking of people who have fielded complaints, we want to bring another voice to the table here. Jerry Foxhoven is on the phone. He's the director of the Department of Human Services. Jerry, can you hear me okay?
I can, Clay. Thanks.
So you've no doubt heard these concerns that we've outlined from the Ombudsman's office. Just want to get your reaction. What do you make of them?
Well, you know, I think I've said from the very beginning, I've been here for 9 months, that we knew there were problems, some problems with Medicaid that we needed to fix, and we have been rolling up our sleeves and working on those. If I can put it in perspective, Clay, we have 640,000 people on Medicaid in Iowa. So if you look, for instance, at the Ombudsman's report, they got 225 complaints in 2017. That's 0.0003% of the people that have Medicaid. So if you think of it like if you were an airline, how many people call you and say, my flight came on time and my luggage was there when I got there? Probably none. The people that you hear from are the people whose luggage didn't get there on time or their flight was delayed or canceled. And a 0.0003% complaint number is very, very, very small. Now, these are really important issues, and that doesn't mean that we shouldn't pay attention to them, and we do. And we try to resolve these things every time they come up. But again, we are turning the corner. I think that the rate of complaint is for the size, the massive size of this program, is pretty reasonable. The other thing that I really want to say is this. When, for instance, the Ombudsman's office complains about a case where the services were reduced by 71% or other cases where services were reduced by a certain percentage, you can't automatically think just because services were reduced, they shouldn't have been. That's a clinical decision that has to be made by doctors. Sometimes when we've come in and taken a look at the program, there are some people who they need more services than they were allowed before, and we try to make that change. There are some people who are being paid for services that they shouldn't be paid for, and that it's costing the taxpayer money to pay for those services, and it needs to be reduced. Those are clinical decisions that have to be made by doctors, and there's a mechanism that's in place to allow people to ask for those decisions to be reviewed. And I think that the legislation that Joyce just talked about will include some provisions that will help push further review whenever there's a reduction in services.
If I may, Jerry Foxhoven, here, the comparison that you make to like an airline and people losing their luggage, I mean, we're talking about a very vulnerable population that might be confused about the way that the system works or even how to voice concerns. Do you not think that there are people out there that don't understand how to voice their concerns?
Well, no, I'm not saying there are only 225 people in the whole state that aren't. What I'm trying to say is, first of all, as the Ombudsman just told you, they don't have a big formal procedure you have to go through to file a complaint with them. They can somebody can send them an email, a phone message, send them a letter. That's it, and it initiates it. And it's been in the press pretty strongly. If you got a complaint, contact them. The same thing's true with the long-term care ombudsman. And so, frankly, people do have a voice, and they have a voice going to their legislators, and every time we hear about a case where there's an issue, we try to resolve it, and we work to try to make sure the right thing is being done in every case. So am I saying these are not people who are vulnerable? No, they are vulnerable, and as I said before, even one or two people that don't get what they need, that concerns us, and we need to do everything we can to provide them services. But you know what? Life is not perfect, and there's no way we can guarantee that all 640,000 Iowans who are on Medicaid are absolutely going to get everything that they want and everything that we need. We're going to do the best we can to get there, but we're never probably going to be 100%.
Joyce, I believe you have a question here.
I was just curious about, you referred, Ms. Hirschman, you referred to long-term support services, and that's for, as I understand it, disabled and elderly people who have long-term, you know, care that they need. And I was wondering how much of this is coming from, how much of these complaints are coming from that population.
I don't have the statistics right in front of me. I'd have to go through all of our cases, but the 55,000 to 60,000 people that receive long-term support services are, I would estimate, are probably part of the larger percentage of our complaints.
Jerry Foxhoven, what are the things that you can do within the constraints of DHS with your budget to make any kinds of changes based on things that you're hearing in media reports and from the Ombudsman's office?
Well, first of all, when we are apprised of an issue, we drill down to it individually. So whether a legislator or even people from the press, when they get a hold of us and say, Joe Schmo says that this is what's happened to him, it isn't fair, we go out and we look at the case, we contact the MCOs, we find out what needs to be done. Secondly, if there is an appeal of some nature, the ultimate decision on the appeal is from me. And we've overruled the MCOs a number of times. Number three, we do have some mechanisms where we can fine the MCOs if they're not doing the right thing and so forth. And we also have a kind of a critical issue liaison that's for members and providers. So we have a liaison that's their whole job, is that they take a look whenever there's a critical issue that comes up. How do we get this resolved? How do we make sure that the member or patient gets everything that they need?
So do you feel that Medicaid is managed effectively through the current model?
It's not perfect. We need to do a lot of work yet. Is this the right direction? We're going in the right direction. We are improving the problems that have been there. And I feel like we're doing, for the number of people that we serve, we're doing quite well.
And what are changes that you're, do you discuss changes on a regular basis within the organization? Are these meetings that take place, or how does the sausage get made, so to speak?
Absolutely. We're continuing to look at how do we change this system better, both in terms of negotiations with the MCOs for the contract, as well as talking to legislators about changing some existing laws and so forth, and intervening in individual cases. We know that things were not going well before. I've been here for 9 months, and I think our director of Medicaid has been here for 2 or 3. And so we've been jumping in, trying to get payments more current. That has improved a great deal. And also in individual cases, intervening to try to get things fixed. What I would tell you is, we know in the long term we can't just intervene in every case when there's a problem. We need to address it systemically, and that's what we're trying to do. But in the meantime, we have to take care of the individual cases. If a member has needs that are not met, we need to fix that first and then deal with the systemic problems at the same time.
I want to ask on a side here, too, because I know we only have you here in the first part of the show, Jerry Foxhoven. Any update on the search for a new managed care organization? I know there's been some search for another one.
Yeah, we did put out an RFP for new one or two MCOs. We have we're in the process of concluding that. We did get a couple of companies that bid for it, responded to the RFP. So that's in process right now. We will either bring in one or two new MCOs, but it wouldn't be until July 1st of 2019. Now, the reason it's going to be over a year from now is, frankly, that was my decision. When AmeriHealth left, we knew we would have to go out and get a bid out for more companies, and I did not want our members to go through so many changes in such a short period of time. So we've been around, 22, 23 months into managed care, and this last year we had one organization that left, one MCO that left, AmeriHealth, And so those patients needed a change over to a different MCO. And I didn't want them to have to change over again in July. It's not fair to our members. And so what we wanted to do was to make it July of 2019 so our members would have some stability, number one. Number two, we also wanted that company or companies that come in July 1st of 2019, that they're prepared to hit the ground running, that they've got all the people hired that they need to hire in Iowa to make sure that they can do a good job, that they've assessed the landscape well enough, and that they know that they can meet the needs of our patients. So I think it was the right thing to do, to say we'll take the bids now, figure out who it's going to be now, and then not implement it until July 1st of 2019.
And Director Foxhoven, before we let you go, there's been talk in the past of possibly taking this most vulnerable population, disabled Iowans who are in these long-term services, and put them back into traditional fee-for-service Medicaid. Many of the complaints are coming from this vulnerable population. Is there any more thought being given to that?
You know, there's always discussion about that. I don't really see that happening, Joyce, and here's part of the reason I would say this is that those long-term needy people, whether they are the disabled people or the seniors that are in nursing homes and so forth, they are a very small percentage of the population, but they're a large percentage of what we spend. For instance, the disabled are a little over 12.5% of the population, but they're almost 40% of what we spend. The seniors are less than 5% of the population. They're over 15% of what we spend. And so while that group is only about 17-18% of the people that we serve, it is over 50% of what we spend money on. And as a result of that, you are never going to bend the cost curve to be able to make Medicaid long-term sustainable to the taxpayer in the long run if we carve that out. So it doesn't really make sense to carve it out at this point. We just have to do a better job of serving them.
And when you hear about the Ombudsman's report, do you see any direct changes that your office can do as a result of that report, anything that you're prioritizing now?
Well, I wouldn't say as a result of the report. We have been doing kind of a constant evaluation. When we get complaints in, when we look, we brought in a new Medicaid director for exactly that reason. He has created a process where he brings in the providers who are the least satisfied with what we've been doing. He didn't pick the people who liked us. He picked the people that had the biggest complaints. He brought them together and on several occasions now, and he's continuing the process for a program improvement to have them give input about what are we doing wrong, what can we do better, how can we improve it. So frankly, it's really it's been very refreshing because what he's done is brought in the people who are most dissatisfied and said, help us solve this problem, and they are. And so that has driven just constant change and improvement in the system. And I think even the providers would say, it's certainly getting better. We're headed in the right direction.
Okay, Jerry Foxhoven, he's the director of the Department of Human Services. That's where he bows out. Director Foxhoven, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Clay.
Are you affected by these changes from Medicaid? What's been your experience working with the system? Call us 866-780-9100, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. We're talking Medicaid. We'll be back after the break with some lawmakers here that are going to weigh in as well. You're listening to River to River on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Clay Masters.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's River to River on Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Clay Masters, in for Ben Kiefer today, live in the State House Law Library, along with Joyce Russell, our State House correspondent. We're talking about Medicaid on the show, specifically concerns that have arose since the management of Medicaid was turned over to for-profit companies in 2016 to manage it. With me in the State House Law Library are Representative Lisa Heddens. She's a Democrat from Ames. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
And Representative Joel Fry. He's a Republican from Osceola. Good afternoon to you as well.
Good afternoon. Thank you.
And are you affected by these changes by Medicaid? What's been your experience working within the system? The number is 866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org is how you can email us, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. And before we talk about legislation that's been introduced, we talked in the first half with the ombudsman who has issued a report. But we want to hear from some of real-life experiences that have happened here. Bev Luke is on the phone. She lives in West Central Yale, Iowa, who's where she calls home. And Bev, welcome to River to River. Bev, are you there?
Yes.
Okay. Can you tell me a little bit about what your personal story is in working with Medicaid?
Well, I have a daughter that is 25 years old. She lives in a group home in Carroll, Iowa, and she has a pretty complicated case medically and also behaviorally. So she is very, very reliant on her services through the insurance companies. I guess you'd call them the MCOs. And we started out, we were very much against privatizing the insurance because Medicaid was working fine. And I'm the belief if it's not broken, you don't fix it. And we, first of all, were given the choice of insurances, and we chose AmeriHealth Caritas. And I think we all know that I believe the second week of November, we got a letter saying that they would be dropping out. And we would get a choice to choose among either AmeriHealth or United Healthcare, and that would be before the end of the year. And December, maybe the last week in November, we got a letter saying December 1st she would be on United Healthcare. So we did not get a choice, which I did call and file a grievance, but they said that was what the way it was. So. Here we are.
Have you been able to keep seeing all of Caitlin's doctors then? Or tell me a little bit about just how this has affected the care for her.
They told me so far, I believe until June, they're going to honor her doctors. And then we're going to have to kind of see if the doctors will stay on with United Healthcare or if they will not. Because that's the big thing is she's got a very complicated case. So we see a neurologist. She has seizures. She has tumors that affect every vital organ of her body. So we see a neurologist, and that's for her seizures and tumors that are in her brain. We see a nephrologist and a urologist because she has tumors in her kidneys. We see, you know, and she has them in her lungs. She has them in her eyes. So you have a variety of doctors that she has to see, and we've just kind of been playing it by ear. And I just recently, we went in December to her neurologist, and I got a bill saying that it wasn't covered, and I'm like, oh, here we go.
And so if, go ahead, sorry, Bev, go ahead.
You know, they called back and said they would, they were sorry, it would be honored until June, and then, you know, they would have to see if they could get signed on, so, but they're on, again, on my part, that takes more time on my part, you know, to you know, call in and get these resubmitted, and it's kind of a nightmare.
If you had one kind of message that you would summarize for those that make decisions here at the State House where we're broadcasting from, what would your takeaway be? What would your message be?
I would just like them to stop and think that these children have complicated medical issues, and they have group homes that they depend on to take care of them and live in. And if that was your child, would you want just anybody taking care of your child, for one? Because these group homes are not being reimbursed efficiently or properly, so they have staff turnover constantly. And I know that these children's care procedures have been denied, and they are not just ones that they opt to have. They are necessary, and they are necessary possibly to keep them alive, and they didn't choose to be handicapped.
All right, so, Bev. Thanks for sharing your story. I want to go to another story about working within the Medicaid system. We have a caller here, Kelsey in Creston. Kelsey, you're on River to River. What are your thoughts here and your perspective?
Hi, Clay. Thank you. I just wanted to comment quickly in regards to Mr. Foxhoven's comments about, you know, painting the larger picture with the numbers about the Ombudsman report. I'm a case manager in the Medicaid system. I worked for the state-run system prior with the elderly waiver and the LTSS population, and then also worked for one of the MCOs for a period of time. And again, find myself still in the Medicaid system. I'm working for a community mental health agency now with the Integrated Health Home Program, which has also kind of been in flux because of this managed care system and wanting to change that. But in regards to his comments, I just wanted to kind of focus, and I think you guys asked that question and the gal from the Department of Aging didn't have the numbers, but I would probably say that a majority of the comments and calls and frustrations are coming from the LTSS population, because those are the folks that have case managers and that see folks regularly, that provide care to them. Obviously, the Medicaid population is a large population, but these LTSS folks that receive case management and receive, you know, they're in a group home or they have a home health aide that comes in, things like that. Those are the ones that will, for lack of better words, visually see the changes, because they'll stop seeing their care provider come into their home because it's been cut. So I kind of just wanted to throw that out there. I think the LTSS population is the one that's probably seeing a lot of the changes or a lot of these impacts the most, because they are the costly, which Jerry Foxhoven commented on. I also want to say that because of managed care, we have more of a middleman than a case manager has ever had before. Previously, when I worked for the state-run system prior to managed care as a case manager, we were kind of like a cog in the wheel. So we helped coordinate all of the services. We would do the funding. We would submit for the funding, I should say, to DHS. And we had a system where we can communicate to DHS. And now, by all means, I will say that the system prior to managed care was, of course, not perfect, and that's never going to be the case. However, to go from what we've gone from with a system to communicate to DHS workers, Medicaid workers, to be able to kind of communicate on a regular basis and see what's happening with our people, just in a database, for example, just one small example, that's no longer the case. So for part of that is they would get a letter sent out to them on an annual basis to renew their financial eligibility to make sure that these people are still financially eligible. As a case manager, we would get notified when that letter went out so we could help make sure that information was getting back in a timely manner. Now we don't have access to that when those letters, for example, are getting sent out.
Okay, great. Kelsey, thank you for your call. I want to throw it over to our lawmakers now who have been sitting by for this conversation. And just Representative Frey, we'll start with you. What is your reaction to what you're hearing today on the show? And what do you make of the legislation that's coming forward and any changes that can take place between now and when lawmakers go home?
Yeah, thank you. As I listen to stories today and as I've received emails or my own phone calls over the legislative session, interim sessions as well, Representative Heat and I, he chairs the Health and Human Services budget. I chair the policy committee in the House. He and I have co-sponsored an amendment back during the policy part of the session, which dealt with many of the issues that we're hearing about today and that the long-term or that the Ombudsman's Office, has put forth in their report as well. That did come back around in House File 2483. And the three key components of that, I think, for folks to know is that we want to make sure that we have accountability to members, accountability to providers, as well as making sure that we have the proper amount of oversight with our managed care system.
And when you say members, let's define that real quick.
Members, those receiving the care. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Members to the MCOs. And so in all of those things, we want to make sure we have timely payments. We want to make sure that we are honoring those payments and billings. And I think the other key piece of this amendment or this bill now is that we are looking at making sure that when there's a reduction of services, that the Department of Human Services is also required to look and give an eye to that to make sure that reduction is appropriate so that it's not just left to the MCOs to determine.
Representative Heddens, how do you what do you take from these conversations that have been taking place here during River to River today?
Well, I too have been receiving a number of calls and emails from constituents throughout the year since the inception of privatization of Medicaid. And, I would concur with what Representative Frey said, is that amendment that is proposed in the House file will certainly help in regards to adding some additional oversight of the managed care companies. I don't think it goes to the length that I would personally like it to go, but it's certainly better than where we're currently at. I'm just looking at the March Managed Care Ombudsman's report. I mean, they had 214 complaints. 61 of them were related to the denial, reduction, or termination of services. And to Joyce's question, the majority of those calls of the total 214 calls were from the LTSS population, the intellectual disability, brain injury, and elderly population.
So where, is there middle ground that's being reached here from lawmakers? I mean, where are the areas of growth here? How are you guys working through the details?
Well, as Joyce indicated, this was a bipartisan effort. Mm-hmm. It came out of all the votes we've had in the House have been bipartisanly supported, overwhelmingly bipartisan. And we're working with the Senate currently to also assure that this legislation would move forward in the Senate, either through the avenue that the bill is today or else in the appropriations process through the Health and Human Services budget.
Representative Heddens, in the committee, you said you, and you've implied that here, that you really wish this bill was stronger. Do you have an idea or two that you had hoped to see in this oversight legislation?
Well, I guess for one, I did kind of hope that we would be able to have more of a hybrid and move that long-term care population into back into fee-for-service, because that is the area where I'm getting the majority of my calls from. I'm certainly not getting them from the folks that are in the Medicaid expansion group or related to folks or children that are in the Hawkeye program, but they are to the ones that are on those Medicaid waivers. We've got some starts in regards to oversight, so I think that is a good avenue to go. As long as we're continuing to review and implement recommended changes, either that comes through the Health Policy Oversight Committee or from the Ombudsman's Office, that's the only way we're going to make this a better system.
The price tag on that earlier bill, I believe, for the state cost was $4.7 million. As I read it, a couple of the things in that bill that cost money is the state will hire an independent auditor to randomly review payments to providers. This has been scaled back to make it more random, to cover less, you know, fewer audits, to make it less expensive. This bill will have the Department of Human Services extend services if a member wins an appeal. The earlier bill would have mandated, you know, would have let the DHS come in and mandate that services be extended even if the person had prevailed in a review. So that cuts back those. Is that going to be enough? I haven't seen an updated fiscal note. Is that going to be enough to satisfy the Senate on the cost of this bill?
Well, I can't, I won't pretend to determine what the Senate will be satisfied with or not. What I can tell you, though, is on the change of the audit, One of the things we really wanted to get to there was the small claims piece of that, because those are oftentimes are smaller dollar amounts that providers aren't going after to try and collect back because they're such small amounts. So we wanted to make sure that providers had the opportunity to be able to go after whatever the range was, and we wanted to see what the audit shows as it relates to those small dollar claims.
One of the things that when we talk about Medicaid, those of us that spend a lot of time thinking about it or reading about it or talking about it on the radio, that we just kind of say, and it's a term that many people might not even know about, but fee-for-service. This is the old model. So, somebody give us a brief explanation about fee-for-service. Every once in a while, we just need to like pause and talk about what we're talking about. Fee-for-service.
Yeah, so it would be an individual who is needing service, and then the department would then pay for that necessary service that individual was receiving. So the agency would bill for it, and then the department would just pay for it. So that was kind of the old fee-for-service. And I would say we still do have some individuals that are still in fee-for-service, ones that are just been identified. They haven't been connected to a managed care company yet. So we still do have some individuals that will stay in fee-for-service.
Because Bev brought that up, the caller from Yale, saying, if it's not broke, don't fix it. What was wrong with the old model in your eyes as lawmakers?
One of the key things, I believe, was sustainability of Medicaid over the long haul. The state's budget, 3/4 of the state's budget is between Medicaid and education today. And so we had to, at some way or some level, begin to look at how we're spending our Medicaid dollars, because at some point, education and Medicaid start to fight with each other within the state's budget.
Did you have something else?
Yeah, you know, I just wanted to comment that we as legislators determined who would be in our Medicaid program. So, I mean, it is a state-federal program. We did do an expansion. We determined what additional services we wanted to provide. So the costs are because of decisions we made. We also made the decision to buy out Medicaid from the counties. So it used to be the state and the feds were a player, and the counties and the federal government were partners. And now that's all state and federal. So that's really what has increased our costs on there. We're talking about very vulnerable Iowans. And so it's very concerning to me, not only as a legislator, but also as a parent of a child with an intellectual disability, to make sure that we are fulfilling the level of support that individuals need to remain as independent as possible.
I think key thing to this is that's what we want to do long term, is that Medicaid is there for the long term for the next generation. And so it's forcing us to look at some of these issues.
I just wondered, as we were listening to Bev Luke's description of her really complicated medical situation for her 25-year-old daughter, she mentioned, among other things, getting bills that she didn't used to get, and also staff turnover at the group home where her daughter stays. Representative Frey, I just wondered if you, we can't address every individual case, but I just wondered if there's anything in this bill that would directly relate to her case.
From the standpoint of reduction of level of services or anything that would relate to the timely billing that the provider would receive back, those, yes, I believe would be in the context of this bill. But you're also now starting to dovetail into workforce. You're starting to dovetail into those going into this profession and how many out there in the workforce are actually entering into this. I will tell you, there's been a workforce issue around this population for years. That's not new to the state of Iowa. I've been here 8 years, and we've talked about the workforce in this area all 8 of my years, and managed care has only been here for 2.5 of those years. And so I think it's a much larger conversation around burnout, around the work that those individuals are doing and how we can make sure individuals are prepared for that.
I think one of the points she was making is that there's delayed payment to providers that just exacerbates that problem of staffing issues.
Certainly. If you don't mind me interjecting, if you don't have, if you're not getting paid timely, or if you're continually month after month not getting paid timely, serving on the Health Policy Oversight Committee, the managed care companies would talk about their clean claims, their quote-unquote clean claims. Well, a provider might be getting paid. They just might not be getting paid the correct amount that was in their contract. So that causes some definite problems. And then when you don't have the dollars to pay your staff, that's going to lead to turnover in your staff. So it's very cyclical. My hope is with the language in the bill, we can tighten up the payment structure so that businesses are getting paid more quickly than what they currently are.
And I would certainly echo that is the design or the desire in the making sure that providers are getting the payments on a timely manner, but as accurate as possible as well.
We've been throwing the number out there. I do want to get to the phone line here as we wrap things up and have another personal story here. Crystal in Iowa Falls. Let's go to Crystal now. Quickly, Crystal, what are your thoughts here on what you're hearing today? And tell me a little bit about your story.
Okay, thanks for having me. My thoughts are this. I have been permanently disabled since I was 25. I will be 35 this year. I am currently receiving Social Security Disability, Medicare, and Medicaid as a secondary if I get a $10 a month job. So if I get a job that pays me $10 a month, then I can have Medicaid for working people. I am permanently disabled for a reason, and having any kind of job was the reason why I'm disabled. I can't do a job, so making me jump through an additional hoop to prove that I can get a job that will pay me a nominal amount for my coverage is very difficult, so that's point one. Point number two is when I have to prove my income 3 or 4 times a year because of oversight between different Medicaid programs, that makes me extremely upset. And then it ends up me having to have calls with people on the phone that are terse and uncomfortable and unpleasant. And it's not anybody on the receiving end's fault, but I get upset that when I'm told I'm going to have coverage for something, and then I get a letter in the mail that says, oh, by the way, 7 months ago, this procedure that you had, or this device that we paid for, what's that for again? Can you let us know? Because we're not really sure. So when I get four calls in a row about that stuff, that's frustrating.
So thank you, Crystal, for your thoughts here. And we're running out of time. I just want to go to reaction here as we wrap things up from both of the representatives that we have here at the table.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a common scenario that we hear from individuals. Either they're having to resubmit paperwork or documentation, either themselves or a provider themselves. I would also say that while there have been several complaints to the state ombudsman's office or the managed care ombudsman's office, I would say that there are thousands of individuals that are not contacting their office. And I certainly refer just about as many people that I know if they're having challenges to their office. because they don't know where to go. They don't know what type of support that they can get.
And Representative Fry, final thoughts here.
Yeah, I would like to say thank you to both of the callers that called in to share their stories. It's stories like that that is having impact on legislation that we're moving forward to try and make the system a better system for all Iowans. So I appreciate the opportunity to be with you all today, and thank you.
All right. Joyce, any parting thoughts here? I mean, are we going to get something wrapped up before lawmakers go home?
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask our legislators. Are we going to get it wrapped up?
I feel confident we will get the session wrapped up, most certainly, and I feel confident that you will see some managed care oversight legislation in the end of the session as well.
Representative, I'd like to say I'm 99% optimistic that we will get some legislation passed through. Again, I would concur with Representative Fry, not sure on the Senate. And as to concluding the legislative session, I'm hoping it's close to April 17th.
All right. Thanks to our guests today. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Lindsay Moon, and Ben Stanton. Its executive producer is Catherine Perkins. We had production help today from John Pimble. I'm Clay Masters, along with Joyce Russell. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.